Okay, so I was trying to think of what to teach, well, early last week, but, you know, then last minute you canceled and went to Beit Shemesh, and I didn't.
We didn't know about it.
But
I
found out Tuesday night, but that was fine. Okay. Anyways, but I mean, honestly, like, if I hadn't been teaching at Migdal, it would have been easier for me to come to Beit Shemesh by like 10 minutes or so, 10, 15 minutes, but I couldn't really do that. It's the opposite way. But I figured that it's worth talking about, if we want to talk about contemporary topics, the halachic ethics surrounding epidemics or pandemics. Considering already, when I was thinking about this 2 weeks ago, the coronavirus, the novel coronavirus, had gotten a bit out of control. And as of when I checked last night, there were, 42,000 cases with over 1,000 deaths and something like that. And it has now outstripped SARS and its ability to spread. So I figured it was a good thing to talk about. What?
That's so scary.
So, okay, before we start, I will note, it is not, I mean, it is worrisome, but many, probably most, I think, not all, but I think definitely most of the people who have died at this point were people who were otherwise immunocompromised and would have potentially died with the common flu. Meaning, the reason that the flu is considered dangerous, besides for the super rare strains that come every X number of decades that kill Dafka healthy people, like people in the prime of their life, the reason flu is such, the reason they encourage people to get flu vaccine is less for people who are, healthy adults, but for categories of people who are immunocompromised. The elderly, people who are already have pre-existing conditions, young babies or infants, and the like. But that being the case, the coronavirus is more contagious, and therefore it has exacerbated those problems. I mean, the whole thing is incredible. You forget just how big China is until they quarantine. Just the city is larger than, is more populous than all of Israel, and the province that they quarantined has, last I looked at it, they quarantined 60 million people. 60 million people. I don't even know. They are, I don't fully understand how China works. In America, if you wanted to build a hospital, it takes years. As a response, 8 days, they built a 1,000-person state-of-the-art hospital to deal with the problem. I don't know how one does that, but in China, you can do that. They built the high-speed train that we have running from Yerushalayim that took 20 years. Mm-hmm. They built one across all of China, which is several thousand miles, in 6 months.
Yeah, I hear they don't take much input from their constituents.
Yeah, that may be part of it. Might. That doesn't make it less impressive. It just means that it may be something that's not morally possible to do. That may be the case. But I figured it was worth talking about this. And that was because I had come across a source sheet by Rabbi John Flug. We have a Rabbi Cheat website where once a week, usually Rabbi Josh Flug puts an outline with makaros for a pre-made shiur, and I happen to see this one. I have some makaros that I would add, but honestly, from the research I've done and from other shiurim I've listened to the topic, most of the central questions are the same, so it was just worth giving you his source sheet. Also, it's nice. I feel like once in a while it's nice to do what he does. I just don't have the patience to do it, which is to not copy everything from Bar Ilan, but to cut out pieces from the Svarim, so at least there's a little bit of character to the Makaro sheet. But I don't have the patience to do that. So if someone else does it, I'll use it once in a while. But I want to talk about some of the issues that come up. So if I ask you, what are the halachic issues that come up with epidemics? What issues do you think we even have to talk about?
If you hold pikuach nefesh as a value, then you want to make sure that it doesn't spread.
Good. So pikuach nefesh is definitely the overarching value here. We want to save lives. But that's sort of not subject to dispute. Okay. That we agree with. But what questions are that then? Yeah.
Do we see that if someone could possibly be sick from the Institute, some kind of like theorem on it?
Good. Right. Well, I don't know if I would call it theorem, but the theorem. But one question is.
Like, could they count for a minion?
Or like, well, let's just say the ethics of quarantine.
Yeah.
Right. However, we want to, right? Full quarantine, partial quarantine, but quarantine, right? Because on the one hand, quarantine is supposed to protect lives. But on the other hand, there are costs to it, right? You're essentially imprisoning someone, preventing them from being with their family, with their friends, from performing mitzvot, whatever the case may be. Yeah, what else?
Also the ethics of, like, you only have a certain amount of vaccine or cure or whatever.
Good, like, right? Allocation of resources. Right? What standards do we have for allocation of resources? Now here, there are sub-questions. What questions do you have within allocations of resources?
What resources to who?
So let's divide it. Like, which types of people would you want to prioritize? What are the questions that go under this category?
Do you prioritize, like, a young child over an adult?
Good. So one question is, right, young versus old, healthy, or otherwise healthy, obviously, versus otherwise sick, and the like. That's one set of questions. There's another set of ethical questions that people ask, which is? Do you give priority, even if you would determine that a healthcare worker would be at a lower rung on the old, young, healthy, sick category? Does the fact that they are healthcare workers and they're involved in dealing with the patients, does that push them up the list for one of two reasons? Either practical reasons, which is we need them to be healthy to help other people, or for fundamental reasons, which is they put... Correct. Third question we have to ask is, is it permitted for the healthcare workers to put themselves at risk to treat people? Right? Right?
It's a meta question. Cause,
correct.
Yeah.
It's a general question, which is, in Pesach it's called, right, being machnes atzmecha lepikuach nefesh, or suffik pikuach nefesh, because once pikuach nefesh is a value, do you have the right to put yourself in danger to help somebody else? Right?
Did we talk about this?
We talked about this in self-driving cars a little bit. Right, a little bit.
Right, but that wasn't to save someone else. We talked about, are you allowed to be in the car?
Right, we talked maybe a little bit about the right or the responsibility to prioritize the self, but here you're actively not, right? They're clearly at higher risk for contracting any disease from the fact that they are putting themselves in danger. What other questions? Right, these are, I think, the three main ones, but what other questions might there be?
What about, like, status? Just, like, in society.
What about?
Like, status in society.
Meaning?
Like, if you're, like, a lawyer versus...
Right, so that...
...worker.
I mean, for that's for what? Within what?
It can go in between, like, two.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right, so this is in... Right? Right, allocation of resources could also be, right, value to society, right? Things like that. Yeah, right, that is another reason you might want to allocate resources in a particular way. So those are a few of the questions. Let's think, what else would there be? Okay, then there are some other questions, which is forcing people to take vaccines, right? That's another question, right? Which is...
Or any other method.
Or whatever, right? Forcing, right, to take medicine, vaccine, whatever, right? Can you coerce people for the greater good or for their own good? Right, those are two separate questions, right? Meaning, one is a question... assuming being healthy is a mitzvah, can you force people to keep themselves healthy? The second is, even if you can't, can you force them to take medicine if it's going to prevent them from spreading a disease to other people, which is now related to the quarantine question.
Could there also be a question of, like, if it, this is, like, add-on, but, like, if there's, like, no cure, like,
So in general, we don't, right, halacha doesn't really, right, allow euthanasia, but theoretically, right, the slightly more modified question, which is, right, can you withhold life-saving treatment, right, or life-extending treatment if the life extension would be painful? Can you allow them to die, right? So, right. Okay, so those are some of the questions that that come up in this. And like I said, the sources here do a pretty good job at summarizing the basic issues. There are other makaros. I'll throw them out as we go along. But there are already a lot of makaros just to deal with this. So I didn't bother adding others from my research to the actual sheets. So let us take 5 to 10 minutes and... let's start with, just because we're going the order of the sheet, let's start with this one, okay? Can you put yourself in danger in order to save others, right? Can the doctors go and put themselves in danger to save people? So that is sources 1, 2, 3, it's really 1 through 7, but try to do 1 through 4, right? Take like 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes, try to do 1 through 4, and then we'll regroup. Though, I don't know how many much covers we have, because we do have to end a little bit early. But let's start with that. Okay, so let us start with the question of whether you have to risk your life, meaning that usually a healthcare worker, do they have to risk their life to save others? So let's look at the sources. If we look at number 1, this is the basic source of the obligation that you have to save somebody else. I think the Gemara derives it from Gufa minayin l'roed chaver shutoveh benahar. How do you know that if you see someone drowning, ol chaya gorarto, or an animal dragging him, ol listin bainalav, or thieves coming to attack him, shuchayev le'tzilo, that you have to save the person? Tamad lomar. The pasuk says, lo tamod al dam re'echa. Don't stand idly by your friend's blood. V'me'acha nafka, me'adam nafka. And where is that the source? We have another source. Aveda gufo minayin. We know we have Allah of Hashavar Aveda, that if you return a lost object. So, is that limited to property, or does it include saving the person himself? Tamad lomar vashevoto lo. You have to return him to him, which implies that even if what is lost is the person's body or health or whatever itself, so you're obligated to return it. So the Gemara says, "Ime hatam have amina hani mili b'nafshev al mitrach umegar egura ema lo kamashma lan." He said, "If we only had the source of hashavat afeida, you might think you have to return it, but you don't actually have to expend money and resources to save someone." Lo tamod raises the bar and says, "You do." Yeah.
So is that sort of like a call to chomer? Just like asking about
halacha. Yes. It's essentially a kavachomer. Okay. Even though it is presented as a drasha, presumably it's some sort of kavachomer. Now, this is one of the sources in general that the poskim offer for why there's a mitzvah to heal people, right? To be a doctor in the first place. So the Gemara says that you have to do it. You have to expend money, right? To spend money to save people. But it doesn't. The Bavli doesn't deal explicitly with the question of whether you even have to put yourself in danger to save. So this is addressed by the Yerushalmi number 2. Rav Imi itzdid b'sif sifei. And Amr Rabbi Yonatan, yichrach hameit b'sadino. Amr Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, ada ana katil, ana mitkatel, ana azil, umishay zivlei b'chayala. Now I understand that the Aramaic is a bit complicated, because it's Yerushalmi Aramaic, but basically it goes like this. That Rav Imi was captured by bandits. So Rav Yonatan or Rav Yochanan said, well, he was captured. Nothing I can do. Let's just prepare the shrouds for his funeral. Meaning, there's nothing I can do. Like, he's gonna die, and there's nothing I can do.
Why is he famous again?
What?
Why is he famous again? He just doesn't seem like such a nice guy.
I mean, there's nothing he can do. Rav Shimon ben Lakish says, no, if they want Rav Imi, they're gonna have to kill me first. Right? Now, it does make sense, sort of in context of Reish Lakish's life, that he's the one who says this, because
he was abandoned in the body.
Right, he was, exactly. Before he became a rabbi, he was a...
It seems opposite.
What?
It seems like it should be...
No, it means he's tough enough. He's like, look, they'll go through me. Like, he didn't lose all that toughness, right, he's saying?
It just seems like it should be opposite. Like, Rabbi Yochanan should be like, no, we should save all the lives, because that's like a Jewish value. And like,
right, but I would just say this is probably more courage. He's like, look, I can.
Be realistic.
You know, Reish Lakish is like, I can handle this. You know,
it's like I'm macho.
So from here, if you look at that, got Maimonia number 3. It says, Yerushalmi Mazik Avila Hachnis Atzmo B'Safek Sakana. The Yerushalmi derives from here that it is clearly obligatory or permitted, unclear, but he thinks obligatory. Right? You could have read the Yerushalmi. Now, you could read the Yerushalmi 2 ways. You could say the Yerushalmi means it's obligatory. You have to risk your life to save other people. Or it could mean you're allowed to risk your life to save other people. So the Haggot Maimoniot says that it sounds like it is obligatory. So do we paskin this way? So if you look at the Beit Yosef in number 4, he quotes the God Maimoniot. He says, "V'kata v'God Maimoniot avar alota mod b'yushalmi masik afil hachnis atzmo safik sakana chayav v'nir'eh shatam b'pnei shahalavaday v'usafik." So the Beit Yosef, first of all, he explains it. And he says, "What's the logic?" The logic is that at the end of the day, the person who's about to die is in vaday danger, and you're only doubtful danger. And that's how he understands it. The Beit Yosef interprets that I got my money, that you are obligated to put yourself in doubtful danger to save someone from certain death.
What does that mean? Like,
so,
like in a situation where you might die, but like...
The person is in a burning building, and he is tied to the... Right, he is tied to the wall. You are a firefighter, you could go in, you might die, you might save them, but if you don't go in...
They will die.
They will die.
Yeah, you would have to also...
Now, you derive a few... So, but this leads us with a few questions, because first of all, it seems clear from the Beit Yosef's interpretation that if you would definitely die, that you don't do that, right? The second is... Yeah?
I just had a question.
Yeah.
It's clear that it would... For a firefighter, I mean, that's their job, but what if you are a random passerby?
Oh, good. So hold that thought for a second. Right now we're just talking about the general question, but we have to come back to that question, because that may change the equation. Okay? So do we paskin this way? The Beit Yosef quotes it, but in Shulchan Aruch, it is not quoted. Right? In Shulchan Aruch, he does not quote it. He quotes the position in the Beit Yosef, and many of the Achronim assume that this is because we do not, in fact, rule this way. That you do not have to. So you look at the Sma number 5. The Sma is Rishua Falk. He's one of the commentaries in Shulchan Aruch. He writes, "Uvagot Maimoniot katvu di Yerushalmi masik tzarich afil lachnis atzmo b'safek sakana avur zeh ve'vio Beit Yosef v'nereh she'atam v'nei she'ahala v'aday v'hu safek ad kan l'shono gam zeh shmito mechaber." But the Shulchan Aruch, in his final code, left it out. He says, "Yesh lomar kevin shaposkim arif haram v'arosh v'tur lo v'yobiskein mishumach yishmitu." So because it's against the majority, it wasn't quoted by the Rambam, the Rosh, the Rif, etc. Why don't they paskin this way? So I won't read the whole thing inside, but if you look at the Aruch L'Neir in 6, he says the reason he thinks that the poskim rejected is because of the Gemara we started with. The Gemara said, from Hashavat Aveida, what do you know? That you have to try to save somebody. From Lo Tamod, you know that you have to spend money. But that means those are the two things in play, which is do it without risking money or spend money. But if there was something more, which is you even have to risk your life to save someone, that should have come up in the discussion rather than the discussion ending at you've got to spend a little bit of money to save someone. And therefore, he thinks that at least the implication of the Bavli is that it is not halacha. Yeah.
How is that a fair assumption, especially when the Bavli itself considers poor people to be like dead people?
Correct. So you could have pushed back and said, right, depends how much money you assume you're spending, and maybe sometimes you'd rather put yourself in some sort of minimal risk than spend a significant percentage of money. That would be the response. And to say, no, you could work it out. Right, that's, I think, you're right, that would be the response. If you look at 7, Ramosha Feinstein explains this slightly differently, why he thinks we don't pask in this way. And he says, Lefiatam Shikatafti, Dilav Glo Tamar al Dam Reyecha, who bedin kol alavin, in the Chayev la Adam, the Kanesh, Besavik Sakana, la Tzalat Chaviro, Mivadai Sakana. He said, the logic is different. And it's like this Lo Tamar al Dam Reyecha, even though the mitzvah is to not let someone die, in the end of the day, what is its status as a Torah value? It's a regular run-of-the-mill love, a prohibition. And the rule for regular prohibitions is you can't violate them unless your life is in danger. But if your life is in danger, your life being in danger allows you to violate all mitzvot in the Torah except for the big three. Which is murder, but not the obligation to save someone. That's just a regular level commandment, an important one, admittedly. But it's not equivalent to murder. And therefore, it goes by the normal rules of a chai bohem, which is that you don't have to risk your life, or maybe you're not allowed to risk your life, for other mitzvot. So he says, "Ein l'chayev adam lachnis mizavek sakana latzalat chaveiro mivadai sakana daha." In general, we don't allow you to violate the Torah, except for the big three. Like by Shabbos, where we make you be mechalal Shabbat rather than die. But then he says, there's a difference. Right? From this analysis, you could have come to the conclusion that, again, you have three possibilities here. One is chayav, two is asur, and the third is
you really shouldn't, but
mutar. You don't have to, but you're allowed to. So Moshe says, look, now Goat Maimini says you're chayav. He said you could have said asur, but Moshe ends up saying it's mutar. Why is it mutar? Because he said, on the one hand, it's a regular lav, and therefore you're not obligated to give up your life to save somebody else. But on the other hand, what is the lav that you're, what is the mitzvah here? Saving a life. So it's not quite the same as everything else. So Ramosha comes with a compromise position, which is, Mistaber sheyeh chiluk lav de lo tamor al dam riecha, mishar lavin linyan isur. To mishar lavin ha asur lachnis atzmo l'safek sakana. Now, Ramosha doesn't know, but I'll throw it out here. In general, it happens to be that there is a machlokas, Tosfot in the Rambam, whether by all mitzvot you're not allowed to give up your life, or you don't have to, but you're allowed to by all 613. The Rambam says, in general, it's asur. Tosfot says, in general, mutar velo chayav. Ramosha here is assuming, like the Rambam, that by 610 mitzvot you're not allowed to give up your life. By three, you have to. But then he qualifies and says, maybe this is different. This is a mid-level. You're allowed to because you're trying to save a life, but you don't have to. And therefore he says, so, even Tosfot only thinks that you can give up your life in a case where it's going to create a kiddush Hashem because you have a non-Jew forcing you to violate the Torah, right? Not a health case, but a case of kiddush Hashem. But here he says, "La'atzil nefesh chaverav gam yirak beisur lav yem butar lachnis atzmo besafek me'acher d'akopanim yutzal nefesh miYisrael." So Moshe says, "I think that whatever you hold in general here is going to be mutar, not chayav and not asur. It'll be permitted for you to risk your life to save someone else's life." Rav Shechter quotes in number 8 that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik paskined like the Agot Maimoniot, that you have to risk your life. And this was how he paskined during a cholera epidemic that happened in Brisk. If you look at 8, he says, Pam aita bebrisk magefat cholera. Even though there was in Brisk a epidemic of cholera, and even though it's very contagious, Reb Chaim ruled that anyone who fainted in the street, you had to help them. So Reb Moshe says, Mutar, Uhalacha. Reb Chaim says, Chayav. Because the people who now fainted are now definitely in danger. And you're only in doubtful danger. And he rules like the Hagot Maimoni. And then he quotes, and he said, Reb Chaim did this himself. He sent his family to bring them to the hospital to help them in their recovery. And then he quotes Rav Eliachim Meizels, who did the same when his city had the plague, and even took off his coat once in the freezing cold to give it to someone who was sicker than him, even though it put himself in more danger. However, this is all for general people. But there may be a twist here, which is, even if you think that regular, average people don't have to, or not, right, or should not put their lives in danger, you could say that this changes once someone is, by profession, a health professional. Because now, you could say this in one of two ways. You could either say, for everyone else, they shouldn't, but this person has to, or, sorry, can, or everyone else can, but he must, because by deciding to be a doctor, a firefighter, whatever, right, it would be ridiculous if someone said, I'm going to be a firefighter by profession, I'll never go into
a building
and put myself in danger. Like, what? Right? That's not what the job is. And therefore, it could be that whatever you hold about a general person, someone who has committed themselves by taking on a job where they know this is the story, and they've learned the expertise that will help them save the people and everything that's involved with it, they now must put themselves in danger. And that is indeed the way the poskim take it. So if you look at 9, 10, and 11, this is a fascinating letter by Rabbi Akiva Eiger that was written during the cholera outbreaks, to explain what you're supposed to do. And he says, so one of the things he says is you should hire healthcare professionals who can deal with the people, clearly just assuming as a given that these people will now be dealing with the patients who have cholera. And then if you look at 11, look at 11 for an English, Nishmat Avraham, Rav Avram, Avraham, Rabbi Dr. Avram Avram. What?
That's
yes, that's it is. But that is his name. He is both a doctor and he's a doctor at Shari Tzedek. And he wrote this code of medical ethics on or medical halacha, Al Seder Shulchan Aruch. He says, Sarach li'en gado, lama in rofe achot, or kol mishim edabel b'chol eshi b'zagam, b'choyav etabel b'chol ha-kazeh. He said, why shouldn't a doctor or a nurse have to take care of this patient? Again, obviously you have to take all necessary precautions into account, but how could you say they don't have to treat them? Who asked you to be a doctor or a nurse? You know what this is. Or an epidemiologist, whatever, right? That's what you do. Right? Like my mother got her training in public health, right after she got her master's in public health, she spent 3 years in the Peace Corps in Botswana. Right? And got hands-on experience in public health. You know what dangers you're going when you go to Botswana, right? You know, she lived in a hut without electricity for 3 years, without, you know, running water. Like, you know the danger.
So coming to Israel must have been like a real relief for her.
What?
So coming to Israel must have been like a real
coming
relief.
To Israel. My mother's born in Israel.
But, oh, she doesn't?
No, she's born in Israel. My mother's Israeli originally, but no. But you know what you're getting yourself into, right? I mean, you didn't, you know, it's not just the diseases, it's like other things also. Like, there were spitting cobras that came out of the toilets and things like that. It's a very, good stories, good stories. Anyways, when I was in second grade, my mother came and told her stories to, like, my class. It was very interesting. It was like, they didn't expect, you know, like, you see my mother, you would not expect this at all. Like, she's, like, sitting there, whenever you see her, she's, like, sitting there knitting, you know, like, that's what she's doing, and like, but then she'll be like, yeah, I had a pet chimpanzee, and, you know, etc. Anyways, but he says, who asked you to be a doctor or a health professional? So therefore, he says that even if a regular person doesn't have to, a healthcare professional who chose this line of work is in fact obligated, taking in all necessary precautions to put themselves at least in suffix sakana, in doubtful risk, to save someone. V'hiskim iti movi rabbi agon v'shua noyworth shlita v'hosim v'jizbru yisarvu l'tapel bo yavru alav lo tamod amreacha. And Rav Neuwirth went further and said, if they don't, they violate lo tamod. But he notes, "Amnam masigun a gadol v'amitin." I'm talking about chayav l'saken etzmo. Yachol asod zod imran tzorcha bekach. He says, again, he doesn't necessarily prove this, but I think it's mistaber. He says this is only if it's like a mild risk, right? Meaning,
like, let's say you have like 20% chance of dying,
or whatever, right? Meaning, he put on the gloves, he put on the suit, right? It's always possible the contamination. There's a chance, but no one's going to say, you know, you're in an emergency situation and you have no way of preparing and you're with an HIV patient and you have no gloves and they're bleeding, you're obligated to, right? He thinks is too much. He thinks that if you want to, at that stage, you're still allowed to. But he says, even that, because he said, look, his logic is basically a doctor, a healthcare professional knows what they're getting into, which is that they are taking a certain type of risk, and they're going to take precautions, but they know it could happen that they'll get sick. But they're not committing to kill themselves. Same with a firefighter, right? They do assess whether the building's about to collapse before they go in. They go in if they know that they're putting their lives in danger, but if the building is in the middle of collapsing, and there's a low chance that they're going to save anybody inside, and a very high chance that they'll die trying, they also don't go in, meaning there is an understanding that you have to put yourself in some risk, but not necessarily that you have to put yourself, you know, at a 90% chance of dying to save somebody. Neuwirth thought that you were allowed to, but again, he doesn't think that you have to. Other posts can echo this as well. In 10, you have from the Shevet Alevi, from Rav Vosner, he says this as well. That chovat harofeim yish chovat l'rovei l'tapel b'cholem machla madbeket misukenet v'ikar b'zman magefa shidlovroch min ha'ir k'sheyesh davar mevuar. Said, can a healthcare professional run away from his post during an outbreak? Is it pshutam z'dorim sh'asur l'rofeim shechim l'olei l'cholim l'vroch l'salik mitafkidam rak yishmeru atzmam k'chol ha'shar l'tabek k'takanat harofa b'itim alalu. Said, look, he proves from Rabbi Akiva Eger's tshuva, take every necessary precaution, but you can't just run away. Okay? Yeah.
Okay, so two questions.
Yeah.
One, what about a case like 9/11, where you have a very extreme situation where you almost, like, the firefighters almost certainly knew that they were going to die.
So Nishman Avram assumes you're allowed to, but you don't have to.
Okay. So yeah. That was
That's what he assumes.
And two, how could you ever have a situation where you don't, like, you have a case where the person should be able to not, they have a choice not to put themselves in danger, like you just said, but then in an epidemic, they're not allowed to save their own life?
by running away.
So again, right, he assumes that this is within a case where they're not definitely going to die. He means, like, they're going to be in a reasonable danger, but the type of danger they knew getting into this profession. Right. Look, everybody knows that working in a hospital,
you're going to get sick.
You can get sick. I mean, everyone knows that the worst place to be if you are immunocompromised is in a hospital, because hospitals are just, it just is, right? That's why you try to get people out. That's why it's pikuach nefesh, to get people out of hospitals often, because if they're immunocompromised, right, there are diseases that go around in hospitals because everyone's immunocompromised, and so many people are immunocompromised.
Most immunocompromised people are in hospitals.
What?
Yeah. At the same time, many immunocompromised people are in hospitals.
Correct, and it's a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, they need to be treated, and the other hand, it's the place where they're likely to get sick, and that's why we do our best, but everyone knows that in the hospital, you are very likely to get sick.
Yeah.
That's like, unfortunately, yadua. Yeah.
Are these similar sources that would be, like, those would be used in, like, a halakhic discussion of, like, the Hippocratic Oath? Like, whether you're...
Yeah, I think it would. Right, that this is similar. I mean, you took certain commitments, and that's the nature of the profession. It's just, yes, there's a trooper like this as well. Okay. So that is question one. The putting self in danger, where basically you get poskim say that everybody is chayev. No one really says it's usser. Most poskim say it's mutter, but maybe chayev if you're a healthcare professional, like, unless it, again, within reasonable danger, not where you're definitely going to die, and the other person, is, you know, that already the poskim are not willing to say you're obligated to, even if they're willing to say that you have the right to, if you want to. Okay, let us move for a moment to the question then of allocation of resources. I wanna make sure I get to that. Yeah. So that is the order that this source sheet is actually in. Is that that's the next question to justify quarantine?
Oh.
So we're going to come back to it. I just want to. I think conceptually it's worth going to allocation of resources. Specifically, the allocation of resources to healthcare professionals. I think it's worth going there. So let's go quickly to allocation of resources. So here. If you go basically to the end of the sources here, to number 31 and on. So, first principles first. If you have one vaccine and it's you or somebody else, what's the halacha? You're allowed, you keep it. Right? You keep it. That allocation of resources clear. Look at 31.
Unless you can split it, right?
Unless you could split it and save both of you, but you have enough just for one.
Two,
right? So that's number 31, where the Gemara says, "Shnayim shehem mahalchem baderech uviyad echad mehem kitum shamayim ashotin shneim meitim v'im shote echad mehem magil liyishuv." If you have one thing of water, if one of you drinks it, you'll make it to safety. If two of you drink it, you'll both die in the desert. So, Darish ben Petura said, "Mutav sheyishtu shneim v'yamutu, v'yira echad mehem b'mitato shel chaveiro, hashebar b'kiva v'li meid, v'cheichicho imach, chayecha kod min chaveircha." So, ben Petura said, both die, you can't watch someone else die. Rabbi Kiva, and this is the way Rabbi Paskin says, no, you always save yourself first, because it's v'cheichicho imach. If there's a you to live with, then you have to support other people. Yeah.
But, like, then are you responsible for the death of your friend because you didn't share your water?
No, that's what you have to do. Right? You have to make a call. Right? You have to make a call. And the call that you make is, halachically, is that you have to keep it. Right? That's and this, remember, we talked about this a lot when we did the self-driving cars, the right of self-preservation in halacha. You have to make a decision. And therefore, I mean, you may be ridden with guilt for the rest of your life. That's not something I can help.
Wait, can their family be, like, eroding?
No. No, because...
It's not considered murder.
No. You have a right to it, right? Someone's going to die. It's not your fault. It's the circumstances that did it. Yeah.
What do you do if you have enough for two people? Let's say there's 10 of you.
Good. So that's... Good. So that's... So, like I said, first question is simply allocation of resources if you're one of the people involved? There the answer is easy. But the next question is, what if there's more than one? And now it's a question of allocating to... What? So maybe, right, if you had, maybe we could argue like tzedakah, if you have it and, you know, you can give it to your children, you'd have that responsibility or that right, however you want to understand it. No, oh, the Heinz dilemma. No, we didn't talk about this. Which one? Oh, of Ein Mavir and Al Midrash. We didn't talk about it here, but it's definitely a potential argument based on, Ein Mavir and Al Mitzvah, right? Because the mitzvah is now in front of you. Save the person. You can't. Now, the Mishnah, in Horiot, has a list of triage principles. It's not clear whether it refers only to pikuach nefesh or it refers to distributing food in staka, but Tosvot assumes that this is a triage of saving lives. You're not going to like all of them, but there's not much I can do. Right? The Mishnah in Uriot is ha'ish kodem li'isha, lachiot l'usha v'daveida. When it comes to saving from death, a man comes first, but when it comes to redeeming from captivity, a woman comes first. When it comes to food, a man comes first. When it comes to clothes, a woman comes first. Kohen, kodem lelevi, levi liyisrael, yisrael lamamzer, mamzer lenatin, natin leger, ger levin meshuchrar, Kohen, then levi, then yisrael, etc. So it's unclear. So if you look, the Tosfot thinks that this is about pikuach nefesh. Shulchan Aruch, the Rama in number 35, does rule this way. The Rama writes that if two people are drowning in a river, you follow this list.
What if it's two men that are of equal status?
So then it doesn't matter, right? But if you look at the Horod Natan in 36, Rav Nassan Gishtetner, he disagrees. And he says, the Rajba thinks this is not about saving lives. This is about staka, where you give food to men first and clothes to women first, right? Because of different calculations, right? When it comes to dignity, so we prefer the dignity of women over men. When it comes to food, so we give it to the men. But it has nothing to do with saving lives. So therefore, he says, so then, there is no source that says that when it comes to saving lives, you prefer, well, any of these people. And therefore, you skip down halfway. He says, Im keng ish lomar, dehechi dishneim tovim bin ahar, lo amrinan de ish kodem, de chiyu v'atal mitviya bin ahar, umitad alav shalo tamad al dam reyecho, mishum avaydat gufo, v'din ze shayach af b'isha, dam ga isha b'chla reyecha. He said, if you reject Tosfot, so then, the Mishnah tells you nothing. It's just about the mitzvah of saving lives, and saving lives are equivalent. Men, women, Kohen, Levi, it's all the same. And therefore he says, Nimsad Ishi Chivatal Kamo Beish, the Daklin Mizonot, the mitzvah he mitzad Vechechiche Imach, etc. Avokshem Omdim, Litva, the Chivatilam, Mitzad Alav, Lo Tamal Dam Recha, Enev Delvin Ish, Lisha Daldraveo Kaya Lav. So some poskim will tell you you should follow this triage. Some poskim will tell you not. The Horot Natan says we don't. Now, last week, Ray Arya Leibowitz came to us, and he pointed out that the one thing that is obvious, though, in poskim, is that this is almost never relevant. Because this, I mean, not almost never relevant, but it's only relevant, according to anybody, if the need is identical. Right? This triage is in a case where everyone is exactly of equal need. They're all same health, same, you know, everything. But if one person is sicker, then everyone will agree that they go first. Right? This is only in a case where literally they're all the exact same health, exact same everything, and now you just need a standard. So then the Rama says we follow this triage principle. Yeah.
Is there a difference, like in, like, let's say, the secular world, where if
you have a non-Jew versus a Jew who you save, or is it just...
What do you mean in the secular world?
Like, would it make a difference if you're...
You're saying we function in a secular world, so do we have more of an obligation?
Oh, functioning in a secular world. Yeah. Maybe, right? It could be that if you're a doctor in a hospital, you just have to follow the principles of triage that are set up in the hospital. It could be, though if you remember, it's very unclear, right? If you remember from the self-driving cars in the MIT study, people actually have all these types of weird preferences that they deal with, and people grapple with what are the ethics of, because when you have to make a decision, it could be the decision is don't make a decision, just whoever comes first. It could be that you need to come up with a principle so that you don't, okay, I'll just say this in brackets. I know it's disturbing sometimes to have these preferences, but there is a reason that we have preferences of any sort, which is to, I think, which is to prevent freezing up in the moment.
Yeah.
Right? Meaning, the worst thing would be someone, right? If you remember when we did the self-driving cars, we watched the scene from the Good Place.
Yeah.
If you're like Chidi, right, and you can't save somebody's life because you're going back and forth, then everybody's going to die. Right? So the point is, sometimes you just need rules, just so, what?
I started watching it after you showed us the clip.
Yeah, well, I started watching after they said, you know, now I've finished everything that's on Netflix Israel, so I'm up to season 4,
yeah.
Which is very frustrating to me. It's very frustrating.
Yep.
But eventually. Look at that, being Makari people to watch The Good Place. It's what? It's very good. But if you're like that, right, it could be that the reason that we have rules is simply because we understand that the worst possible situation is freezing. Right, is where you don't know what to do. Well, this would tell me to do that. This would, because then everyone will die. So you need rules of some sort. Okay, I tend to think that's probably true. Okay. However, many of the poskim note that I don't want to get too much. So poskim also get into the question: can I prioritize people? So most of the poskim assume you can prioritize people that are more likely to survive than people that aren't likely to survive. That seems pretty obvious. Poskim have discussions about are you allowed to prioritize people who are likely to live longer, right? Like if you have two groups which are in danger, right, which are the very elderly and the very young, do you prioritize the infant or the, you know, 90-year-old who's already sick? So many poskim say in that case, again, it's legitimate to go with the child. That type of thing can come in. It's a bit complicated.
Is there anyone who says you should go for the older person?
Not that I know of, offhand. Some people will say it makes no difference.
Like if you have a rabbi versus like a teenager.
Well, so that gets into the Talmud Chacham question, whether that's actually a preference here, which is the Mishnah in Horiyot, which is the same as all the other the questions related. Do we follow that list? The question that interests me more, though it's not, I don't think it's on this shore sheet, but I'll say it outside, is healthcare professionals. I mean, here, both secular ethics and halacha seem to mandate that we, that whatever you think about all these, young, old, healthy, sick, value to society, all that, we give priority to healthcare professionals. And this is for a few reasons. One is the obvious, which is if they die, no one's taking care of everybody else. Right? So this is, right, for practical reasons. But there is a more fundamental reason. And that is, two more fundamental reasons that both secular ethicists and post can bring up. One is, it's one of the ways that you encourage people to
be healthcare professionals.
Exactly. Right? Is to go into the profession. If they think you're not going to take care of them first, but they know they're putting themselves in danger, right? Part of it is you encourage people to enter into professions that have a little bit of danger if you prioritize them when you're saving people. So again, ethicists bring this up and post can bring this up. Post can bring this up also in the context of the army, right? Rav Gorin brings this up and others, that one of the reasons that we save soldiers and will trade soldiers, some of the post can be justified, even yoter mikdei demayan, right? No matter what it takes, is because we want them to have morale. We want them to know that we're there for them. That's important.
Which is really ironic, because the
army tells them all the time, like, if you get captured, like, just stop them.
Yeah, that's a different side. Another one is what Rabbi Yaakov Ariel writes, which is, he writes this by soldiers, but Poskim have applied this as well to healthcare professionals, which it's not just practical and it's not just for morale, but it's because they are your messengers. And you have a special responsibility to the people that society has sent to be involved in the dangerous activity. That itself means that you're responsible. Rabbi Yaakov Ariel says this by soldiers, that you, just like if you set up a factory, you're responsible for the safety of your workers in the factory because it's your factory, they're working for you, and that gives you more responsibility to check the safety codes than it does in a building that you don't own, or a building that you own, you don't have workers there. The same thing is true of the army, that you are the government's representatives, and therefore, as much as they are responsible for all their citizens, they are more responsible for you. And the same is true of healthcare professionals. You aren't just a random citizen, you are the citizen that is representing society in taking care of the sick, and therefore, we have a special responsibility as a society to you. And again, you'll find this in secular ethics, you'll find this in Poskim, both on medical issues and on the army discussions, where they assume that whatever you think about allocating resources to young, old, men, women, Talmud Chacham, not Talmud Chacham, all of that, there seems to be, for practical, psychological, and ethical perspectives, reasons to prioritize the healthcare workers, or the soldiers in the army being a almost identical or at least similar halachic case to that. So when it comes to allocation of resources, again, we could do this over 2 weeks, and then we could get much more into detail on this. I don't know if it's worth doing that, like getting into every question on. Now, generally, Poskim do agree on this one. Right? Meaning chance of survival, Poskim agree on. Right? This is pretty muskam, that if one person has a better chance of survival than the other, then that's someone you would prioritize. The young versus old is a bit more controversial, both in secular ethics and in halacha. There are Poskim who go in this direction. I think it's from Moshe, who entertains the possibility that you're allowed to do this, but I have to go back and check. The Talmud Chacham case, if you think that's about saving lives, may indicate that we're allowed to prioritize people who have more of a value to society. And we have that in Pidyon Shvuyim as well, that the Gemara notes the possibility that for a Talmud Chacham, you're allowed to save him even for more money than you would a normal person. And again, the reason may be because we recognize that one of the things that we're allowed to take into account is value to society. So again, disclaimer that this is not a extensive discussion of it. There definitely are Poskim who think we're allowed to take into account some of these factors. The one that interests me more for the moment is that almost all ethicists and Poskim assume that you're allowed to prioritize healthcare workers for the practical, ethical, and moral reasons. Yeah.
I don't understand the value to society thing, like the hierarchy that we set up, because who's to say that, like, I don't know, some random guy that you see might like end up curing cancer, like,
correct, like, and therefore, so you don't necessarily know, but if you you have to work with what you have, and that's why some folks can think you can, right? Some folks can think you can value. Again, it's not.
Before you save anyone, are you supposed to like put the time machine and look at their life?
No, but that right, obviously you can't do that.
No, obviously you only look at what's in front of you. You have to make a decision based on that.
I guess it just bothers me that some of these like hierarchical things are not based on their actual merit, but like on like where they were born. Like if you were born into being a Kohen, that has no impact on who you are. And especially if you live in a...
Correct, but we saw that's already a machloket, right? You have the Rama who thinks, yeah, but... And again, that's why I think the moral argument behind prioritizing those people is less that they're more important, and just that it's better to have rules than have someone freeze up because they don't know what to do. Because you'd rather save someone. And often, what happens when there's no rules and no principles, then people just...
I get the point of having a system. I just want to agree with the system.
Again, and we saw that to Machloket, the Rama seems, and Beit Yosef seems that the world doesn't be stat in your notes, and many of you shouldn't reject that. And say when it comes to saving a life, you just save a life. It doesn't matter. And that's why what I wanted to focus on more was this one, where what does seem to be Liskam amongst post-Kim and ethicists is that healthcare professionals do get this a brand, which again, I think connects conceptually to this. If we expect that healthcare professionals have a higher responsibility to risk their lives, we should also, by the same logic, require ourselves to expend, right? If there is a choice to who to save, that we have to give them preference. I think those things morally are related. They're practically related, obviously, right? But this is, I mean, think about it. Obviously, if you have X number of vaccines, we give it to the healthcare professionals first so that they survive and can continue to treat the patients, right? There is a practical component that's undeniable.
But I'm just, like, especially if we live in a time where we don't have a Beit HaMikdash, so, like, the Kohanim...
Correct, and this is...
I
understand the tension with it, I really do. And that's what I said. I said, you're not going to like this sources, and many post-Kim don't like it. Again, Renefson Gestetner thinks that we just don't. This is not part of the cheshbon, right? We don't do these triage priorities. The Rama says we do, and there is there's been a lot written on this topic. And again, if we did this over 2 weeks, if you want, tomorrow next week we could just spend time on allocation reserves. I feel like it's you know not worth spending a whole extra week on it. But if you wanted to, we could. Okay, let's at least try to get some basic issues down on the other questions here. Quarantine. Okay, can you quarantine people? So, why should we even be concerned about quarantining people? I mean, why is it... Before we get to why you might be allowed to, why should we even be concerned about quarantining? Like, why shouldn't we quarantine people? Yeah, so the reason really is, and I was listening to a shiur by Rabbi Mordechai Turchiner, and he said, look, it's the same reason the poskim oppose on principle prison. Right, the reason Torah doesn't have prison, because we don't believe that that's like keeping someone cooped up for, especially, even when they did something wrong, that's not a punishment that we have.
Yeah.
Kal vachomer, when under normal circumstances, right, you don't think locking someone in a room is a good thing. Taking away their freedom is a problem. So quarantine is at least something that has to be justified. Right? Turchiner quoted Chaim David Halevi's piece on all the reasons that we don't like prison in Halacha. I don't think we need to go through that whole proof, but the point is, you need to justify putting people in quarantine, which is just another way of saying temporary imprisonment, not for a crime. Okay? It may be justified, but we need to justify it. That's the first point I would make. So what would the category be? Yeah, question before that.
Well, it's just like more of a comment, but like it depends like what you see as like the purpose of prison in the first place. Like if you see it as like a punishment for the person who's being put in prison, or like protection for society. Like there's
correct.
Like, you can make like very little argument that somebody who's like in prison for like nonviolent drug possession is like it's like helping society that person's there rather than like a murderer, which could be, like, a murderer could more be likened to, like, a person who has...
So, yes, the only case where we sort of have prison is by a murderer, where we have kippa under certain circumstances, but it's not really prison, it's just a delayed form of execution.
Right.
You're right that prison could be a form of containment, but that only assumes that it's better to contain someone in prison rather than eliminate that person from society.
But
when it comes to a murderer, let's say.
No, but
again, the halacha might just be if someone's violated a murderer, then the answer is halacha says right. put them to death, not imprison them.
Yeah.
Prison is a fascinating topic in its own right. Also a topic worth doing, but for now we'll just assert that putting someone in essentially prison needs at least to be justified. That's all I would need for this purpose, because quarantine is clearly not a punishment, it's just to protect people. So what category would we have to justify quarantine then, if we want to justify it? Right, or what you said before, which is potentially rodeif. Right, because it's not just pikuach nefesh. The question is, why is it justified for me to take it out on the sick person for the sake of other people? And the answer may be rodeif. That the person is, right, we have this category in halacha of rodeif, that if someone is putting someone else's life in danger, this is 12. So now you'd say, okay, but this person is not trying to kill people. That's true. But, okay, I'm just debating which sources to actually look at here. How much time do we have? This is like 20 minutes. No, he said whenever they come in. So, okay. So let me summarize it. So there's basically two directions now you can take with the rodeif. One, which I think is the most promising, some of the posts can go in other directions, is simply noting that rodeif doesn't always mean someone who's guilty. Right? There are two aspects to rodeif. One is that one reason that you can kill a rodeif who's trying to kill somebody else is because of the sin that they're trying to murder. The other is because the category of rodeif tells you that you are allowed to protect people, even at extreme cost, from being killed. Sometimes rodeif clearly means rodeif means that you're allowed to save somebody, even at the expense of somebody else's life. So to give the classic example, the Gemara says if you have a woman who is giving birth, and she's going to die if she goes through with a childbirth, so the Gemara says that until the baby sticks its head out, so what's the halacha? You kill the child, right? The unborn child. Once the baby's head is out, you have to let nature run its course. And even though it's true that technically the kid is killing the mother, the Gemara says, Mishamayim karad file. It's not the baby, it's God, it's nature. But if it weren't for that argument, what that indicates is, this is not about culpability. It's not about culpability. There is a level at which rodeif justifies, right, because clearly killing the unborn child is not something we're happy about, but we do it to save the mother. It's not that the baby is a sinner, the baby isn't trying to kill the mother, but the reality is that the baby is killing the mother. And therefore you can save the mother's life by killing the baby. And therefore you have this element of rodeif that's not about sin, it's about simply the right to do something to protect people, which is otherwise problematic, right? The second element is this potential sin component. So here I'll run through a little bit of a summary. The poskim deal with, there's an article here from Ramoshe Sokolovsky, that it's a number 13 here, where he deals with these two elements, right? That rodeif is both to save the victim and because of the certain sin that the rodeif is involved in. He notes that you could create a case in which the rodeif wants to kill his victim via grumma in a way that wouldn't be liable in court. Right? In court, you have to kill someone directly. But if you plant a bomb in somebody's car, you're not chayev. You can't actually put someone to death as a murderer because they didn't actively kill the person. It's grumma.
Is that a real thing?
Yes.
And like, what about today law? Yes?
Like, meaning it's bad. It's clearly terrible. It's just not technically murder.
Put people in jail for it.
Correct. I'm not talking in secular. I'm saying in halacha, that's murderly de grumma. Okay. Well, think about it. You don't know the person's going to go into the car. It might blow up before they go. It's not the same as shooting them. It's just not. So, for technical reasons. But do you think that you could kill the person who's trying to plant the bomb, if that's the only way to protect the victim? The answer is probably yes. Right? Even though he's not technically Chayav Misa, it doesn't matter. Right? There's an Avera involved, but not murderer per se, but you're neutralizing him to save the victim.
So you can preemptively kill someone?
Correct. Okay. Additionally, you have cases where the Gra says explicitly, you know, we get this with like a child. What if a child is trying to kill somebody? So halachically, morally, the child is inculpable. But are you allowed to kill the child who's trying to shoot somebody else? The answer is yes. Because even though the 7-year-old isn't culpable in a moral sense, they are the rodef. So if you look at 14, the Ramah writes, Mishas misakein rabim kigon sheosek bezivufim makom malchot makvido dino kirodef umatar lemosrom malchot, someone who puts the people in danger, such as he's involved in forgery, and the government takes that out on the whole community. You're allowed to give that person over to the government, even though the Gra writes, Avo bishen kavanato l'sakein, right? The person wants to make money, so he's forging currency. The fact that the government's going to take it on the Jewish community is not, right, that's not what he meant. He was just dishonest. So why can you give him over to the government, which puts his life in danger? The answer is because he's a rodef. Right, rodef isn't just, are you chayav misa? There is this element of rodef, which is that you, if you are the one responsible, so we can take, we can save other people at your expense. And this is true even by a case of safek, under certain circumstances. So how does this apply then? So how do we apply these types of categories to contagious diseases? So there, many of the modern discussions I've seen have pointed to this sort of strange tshuva by Reb Elyashiv that I'm not fully sure what to make of. In Rabbi Yashiv was asked the following. There was a woman who contracted HIV, a prostitute, it seems, in this case, and now she wanted to basically take the world down with her. She decided that, like, the way she was going to deal with it was that she was just going to try to sleep around with people and infect as many people as she could. That was what she wanted to do. I don't really know how the Shaila got to Rabbi Yashiv exactly, but that's what she wanted to do. So can you kill her? What?
Is this a Jewish woman?
I guess. So Rabbi Yashiv, so Rabbi Yashiv had a surprising position where he thought that she is not considered a rodef because, you know, everyone sort of knows the risk of sleeping with unprotected with a prostitute. That's, you know, she's not trying to kill people. She's just trying to entice people to be with her, and they know the cost, which is very odd. But Reb Shlomo Zalman in Nishmas Avram in 20 is quoted as saying, look, leave aside the prostitute case. He says a much more direct and simpler case, which is, let's say a spouse doesn't want to tell, right, his or her spouse, that he or her has AIDS. Is that a problem of rodef? At least that, not that you could kill the spouse, but that the doctor is allowed to breach confidentiality to tell the other spouse. So what would you say?
Yes.
Obviously yes, right? Here, I'm very confused with Yashiv. I would have said that even if the woman's a prostitute, and even if the people shouldn't be sleeping with her, still, you should have the right. That should be rodef. She's trying to get people ill. You're allowed to stop her. I don't know if you can kill her, right? But you should be able. You should stop her. That's clear to me. And at least the extent that you're allowed to invoke things. And again, I think in rodef you have these two things. One is it formally rodef such that you can kill the person? And the second is this enough like rodef that we're allowed to breach confidentiality or put you in quarantine or violate other things that we wouldn't want to violate? I don't know if you're formally rodef. I don't know if I'd be comfortable killing the prostitute, but I think it's obvious that you could breach confidentiality, right? You could imprison her if that's the only way to stop her. That, I think, is obvious. That's what Shlomo Zalman says. He says, Adam shuv chan, shuhu noseh negiv shel aids, heim chayvim lomar gam liishto, said, do you have to tell your wife that you have, if someone has AIDS? The answer is, yes. Obviously, yes. And he goes through the statistics, even though they're obviously different now that they've actually managed to somewhat keep it under control and save people and etc. But he says it is obvious that the doctor is allowed to breach confidentiality to protect the spouse.
When was the tshuva written?
Shlomo Zalman, I'm not sure. I mean, he died in the 90s. Relatively recently. Ryashev also died in, you know, only a few years ago. So these are relatively recent Shuvot. So here in Rav Flug's summary, he says that according to Ryashev, you might have said that the only reason he didn't consider this prostitute a rodefet was because of his argument that she didn't tell anybody to sleep with her, she just enticed them. I'm not sure. But I would say, all that really gets you to is that you can't kill her. But the legitimacy of doing other things which are generally problematic, like quarantining, I think it's obvious that Rav Shlomo Zalman is correct. Right? That if someone is putting other people in danger, again, it may not be their fault. But, you know, I would be willing to, I could see a posek saying, it depends. If you have to quarantine them for life, right? I think you'd have to ask the question with more seriousness. But if the question is quarantining them for a week or two, until you're sure they're not going to put people in danger, I think Rav Shlomo Zalman's argument basically leads you to the obvious, which is you're allowed to quarantine them because of the principles of Rodit, that you're allowed to at least, it's like the case of the unborn child. It's not technically murder, but we don't actively want to abort children, but if that's the only way to save the mother, then we'll do it. We don't want to quarantine someone, but if the only way to protect people is quarantine them for a week or two, so it's obvious you can do that. Again, if it's a lifetime quarantine, and it's because they have a 5% chance or a 3% chance of passing on the disease, so then we might have to figure out at what point does the cost of the person outweigh the risk to society. I could hear that happening, but realistically, what you're talking about in most quarantines, which is a week or two, 3-4 weeks, to prevent a very highly contagious disease from spreading to many people, like this right, this cruise ship. There's a cruise ship now where there was an outbreak of the coronavirus, so they're quarantined there for a few weeks. They're not sure exactly when. They think they'll be out by the 21st, 25th, something like that. Again, you know, it's not comfortable. They're on a cruise ship. You know, they're alternating who gets to be in their room and who gets time on the deck. It's not the ideal, but, you know, and I saw yesterday an interview. I was, like, looking around. I saw an interview with one of the women from the cruise ship who was in the hospital already. And you could see the disconnect. The interviewer was like, you know, how are you doing? Are you okay? And the woman was just like, yeah, I sort of feel like I have a cold. She's like, it's very contagious, but it's not particularly different than the flu. I had like a low-grade fever, and I had a cough and a sneeze, and whatever. So I'm stuck here in the hospital for a week or two. They check on me every few hours. And the interviewer kept saying, isn't it terrible? She's like, look, I mean, you know, it's not great. I want to go back to work. I don't know when I'm going, but there are worse things that can happen.
What if you run out of food on this cruise ship?
What if
they run out of food?
Then we gotta figure it out.
I think they're bringing.
No, they're bringing food on. They're bringing food on. I mean, they're at port. They brought them to port.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. They're out in the middle of the ocean. They brought them to port when they realized that there were people with the coronavirus, and now, but they're staying. They're quarantined on the boat.
Okay.
Okay. What about quarantining? Like they're doing now in China, not just a person or a few people, but what about an entire area, which is what they've done in China, where they've quarantined 60 million people, right? So again, the numbers are mind-boggling. They've quarantined 60 million people, which is...
Who are they quarantining?
quarantining them from?
The other
16 million people is alone?
If you have over a billion...
You have over a billion people. Think about that's, you know, it's less than 10%. It's 6% of your population. 5-6% of your population from the other 95% of your population. Which, again, when you think about the numbers in China, it's just like, you know, it's just like, it's always... My brain just starts to explode every time you try to think about the numbers in China. What?
5% of their population, alone, just the statistics are mind-boggling. Never mind the actual reality of what those
people are. Yes, everything in that is mind-boggling, but can you do that? So, there's this interesting piece, in that same piece from Rabbi Akiva Eiger, this is number 22, where he was asked what you should do during the cholera epidemic. He said as follows. He was asked, "Minyan tefila bebeit kneset, should you have minyanim in shul?" So he said, "Lidati ze'emet shekibun v'kom tsar ino nachon." Said, you're not supposed to have a lot of people in one place. "Aval efshar litpalel kitot kitot, but I would let you have small minyanim v'chol pam emetei me'at erech tedvev an Hashem." I would say, you want to have a minyan, maybe have it with 15 people. V'yad chiluk or a boker, try to do it early in the morning when no one's there. V'achare chad acheret, v'yam yuchad lan Hashem shel a'elu b'ezu z'man yavol litpalel sham. Now this seems to be an attempt to compromise, which is, on the one hand, we don't want to imprison all these people and say, you know, there's some people sick, so everyone stay in your house. Because we've said quarantining and the related things are not ideal. On the other hand, it's clearly a legitimate way of limiting the spread of disease. So Rabbi Eiger seems to be trying to come up with some sort of compromise, which is, yes, it's legitimate, but you've got to, you know, you've got to take into account the best way of doing it. And again, if we could get away with not full quarantine, but enough quarantine to limit spread, right? Would we do that? Yes. Meaning that basically what emerges is that, yes, is quarantine legitimate? I think most poskim would say in the end of the day, a temporary quarantine of someone who's definitely going to spread a dangerous disease is legitimate. When it gets to a large group of people and the risks go down and it's just being overly cautious, at what point do we say you're essentially imprisoning 60 million people who don't need to be imprisoned? You really need to have a cheshbon. And the answer might be not a full quarantine, but a partial quarantine. I mean, it's clear you need to do something. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger seems to be grappling with this. That, you know, and again, if this had happened in America, the chances that America could do what China did and say, take 5% of its population, you know, so nagid 15, 16 million people and quarantine them, in America this wouldn't fly. Right? It wouldn't fly, right? If someone said, look, the danger is real but not imminent, how are you going to convince Americans to let 16 million people be quarantined? That you couldn't do it. China can do it because it's China. Right? What? Yeah, because it's China. So I think that in general, this is the direction the post-skim take, is that they do think that fundamentally quarantine is a legitimate tool, but it's not something we jump to, and therefore, when it starts to get to huge scale and the danger is less, right? You're not talking about the one person, you're quarantining one person who definitely has Ebola, right? And you don't want them to go to Times Square, right? That's obvious, right? When it's 60 million people, of which, you know, yes, admittedly tens of thousands of them have the disease, but, you know, 1,000 people have died out of 42,000, which is a lot. But still, is that a legitimate reason to quarantine 60 million people for months on end? Again, the postgame would say, it's a legitimate tool, but it needs to be used with chachma, and maybe there are compromise ways, like what Rabbi Akiva Eiger was trying to formulate. Okay, we have 5 minutes, so quickly, the forced inoculation is related to this as well. Because again, forced inoculation, you would say that's really problematic. We don't usually take away people's rights. I don't want to get into the question of whether you're allowed to force someone to save themselves. That's an interesting question, but that's really beyond our scope. Let's focus on, can you force the person in order to protect others? So again, if giving them a vaccine would save other people's lives, and that was the only way to protect other people, then presumably some of the same arguments that are used for road death and the like could be used to justify forcing it. Whether you can force people to save themselves, so here it's a little bit complicated for a few reasons. One is a vaccine is different than medication, right? Meaning, it's one question, can you force someone to take medicine to save their life? The second question is, can you force them to take something that would protect their lives in potential, but they might not be exposed to the disease to begin with?
If you don't, like, tell them, like, if you just put in their IV or something.
So again, are you allowed to do that? So the post-game in general, the Yehuda has a distinction between what's called chol lefaneinu and chol she'en lefaneinu, when the danger is imminent, more things are legitimate than when the danger is not imminent. This might be considered not imminent. The Chazon Ish has a slightly different standard of whether it's actually the chola is in front of you, and the real criteria is whether there is it enough of a public concern that people would start, you know, davening for that person, right? That's the level of danger where pikuach nefesh really kicks in, and, you know, giving a vaccine, that's not usually it. The person doesn't have the disease yet. If someone's actually in a life-threatening situation, are you allowed to force them to take medicine? So the Magen Avraham thinks in general, yes. But Rabbi Yaakov Emden says that's only if there's not a counterclaim. Right? Meaning, if someone says, I don't want you to save me because the life that I would live is too painful, then Rabbi Yaakov Emden says you can't force someone to take medicine. But if the question is just, I have a death wish, so then the Magen Avraham says, yes, you're allowed to force people. This is a discussion in post-gim. Again, if you guys want to, next week we could come back to some of these issues we've thrown out more in depth, the forcing people to take medication, come back maybe to allocation of resources, or we can suffice with this, and having thrown out basic sources and basic discussions of it, you tell me what you want to do. Again, disclaimers that we haven't exhausted it. I don't know if you want to come back to them. There were some issues that people were interested in, or if you just want to move on to another topic and say, you know, these are the issues. You can read through the rest of the Makaros if you want. You want to continue?
Okay.
If you want to continue, we'll come back to some of the. You don't want to continue.
I mean, we don't have time
moving on, but I'd also be fine continuing.
Yeah, okay, so we've thrown out the issues. Maybe next week we'll look more in depth at some of these questions.
You said you wouldn't have so much time to prepare, so we can just continue.
Yeah, we can continue, and I have some other makaros prepared on some of these issues. So okay, fine. So let's do that. Let's try to. We've thrown out all the basic contours of the arguments, but we'll come back to some that we've glossed over in the last few minutes next week.
Okay.